Over the last couple of years, I've been involved in three things that, in my opinion, require kinetic theory and that I consider as somewhat exotic because they lead astray from our normal fields, yet they link rather closely with what we do. And one of these three topics is the traffic flow problem, about which I've lectured rather extensively, so I know there are some people in the audience who have heard at least some of it. But I have two others that I will at least advertise for today, and I hope you'll find this entertaining. This is a rather non-technical talk, quite appropriate for the early hour, I think, and I hope you will enjoy it. I will interrupt it with a movie, right? Usually the movies get interrupted with commercials. I will interrupt my commercials with a movie. So maybe we can kill the lights. Here's a listing of my three exotic applications, and they are not exactly in the order in which I... they are not... I also had a pointer here somewhere. Boy, all this technology. Oh, here it is. Okay, now I need to figure out how to work this. Oh, it works. Okay, so I will start with the Fokker-Planck models, which we have developed over the last couple of years for multi-lane traffic flow. And I, since not everybody here has seen this before, I will do a brief repetition of the derivation and the introduction. So that's my first part, revisit the model and its rationale. And then I will show you some analytic and numerical arguments that show some expected and some unexpected behavior of the solutions of this model. And this is also where I have the movie to show you. So I will spend probably about half an hour, 35 minutes talking about traffic. Then I have a rather unusual problem, which actually is well studied in the literature, I know that, but I can tell you about an application that I consider rather exciting. This, by the way, all of these are on a joint work with a number of people. The first problem is joined with Michael Herty, who is a PhD student out of Darmstadt, who made the movies and the numerical simulations. Axel Klar, who was my student at one time, but now is my grandfather in the sense that he has brought me into traffic dynamics. Then there is Thorsten Materne, who was involved with the first development. My postdoc, Vlad Panferov, who's done some of the analysis. There's also a paper joined with Jean Dolbo, who is in the audience, and myself. Second project here was brought to me by Michael Jung from the Institute for Technomathematics in Kaiserslautern, and I'll tell you what the problem is about. The third one is the coal dust problem, and I'll get to that at the end. So, traffic. Okay, instead of talking at length about what happens on the freeway, I invite you to go out and drive on the Toronto freeway in rush hour, and you will immediately see that we have a problem. Okay? In order to model traffic, the model that I want to discuss is, of course, a kinetic model, because this is a kinetic workshop. And in fact, I've argued that we should really study Fokker-Planck models for traffic, mostly on dimensional grounds. I don't want to go into this too far. So let me, by the way, I made a great effort here to produce transparencies in tech or LaTeX, and then when I had them, I couldn't stand them. So I started to write on them. Right? This is my method. Okay, so we have two lanes, and we have kinetic densities on the two lanes, and we have the speed limit, which I simply took to be 1, because I'm a mathematician, everything is cast without constants to begin with. Every constant is 1 by and large, but you can, of course, include dimensions wherever you need them. And dimensions are important. For example, the dimension of my density is a number density per unit length and unit speed. Okay, so it comes out, if you measure length in meters, this is what you get. What we're going to need extensively are the moments of these densities, which I denote by rho I for the macroscopic density and j I for the macroscopic flux. And then there is a macroscopic velocity. By the way, this is an ordinary product, not a cross product, because everything is scalar here, right? We are in one dimension. And the equations, I need to talk a little bit about the structure of the equations, are kinetic equations Fokker-Planck systems. For each lane, we get a transport equation. And then we get, I don't call it a collision term. We get an interaction term, which includes a variety of things. There is, first of all, this guy here. This would be a force. And the force, of course, that we apply in traffic is either due to braking or acceleration. So we are going to have to specify what this B of S is going to be in a particular scenario. I'm going to do this down below, but I'll cover this up for the time being because I don't want you to get distracted. Then there is a diffusion, which is quite important, and I'm going to talk about that also at length in some detail. And then there are lane-changing terms on the right-hand side, which include lane-changing rates. Yes? Oh, I'll get to that. No problem. It's very important, and it's included. But, I mean, I'll start from the general and get more specific as I go along. So, now, let's look at these. There are three main ingredients, right? The braking acceleration forces, the diffusion, and the lane change rates. By the way, I mean, this is just a convenient way here of writing the two lanes. And let's look at the braking force. By the way, the index B here that I added and the index A here is an index that stands for braking and acceleration. And in that index, I hide non-localities due to time delays. So that on the next transparency, you see how I'm going to define these. For the time being, just take a good look at this term here. Suppose UB you should think of as the observed speed that you see as you are a driver at X, moving with V, you observe in front of you a speed UB, and you react to that. Okay? How do you react? Well, you react proportional. I put in here the square of your relative speed. Of course, you brake. That's why there is a minus sign. And this Q is essentially proportional to the density times the braking probability. See, because you are on a multiple-lane highway, you don't really have to brake. You have the option to change lanes if you can. And so there is a probability hidden in there that I'm going to explain in a moment. And by the way, if you set it up the way I've done here, if you make this a square and you hide a factor rho in here, then CB turns out to be dimensionless. This has a weak battery. I can barely see it myself. In the acceleration scenario, you set things up a little bit differently. By the way, first of all, of course, you should be moving slower than the observed speed in front of you. And there is also an observed speed a little further ahead that you will try to look at before you accelerate. This is not, I didn't make this up, by the way. This is stuff that you hear from traffic psychologists. And because the model includes non-localities, you have to be rather careful. These that I've written here are actually implicit in V. So they don't even cover all possibilities. Which means sometimes, of course, you make these decisions at the spur of the moment when you drive. But this doesn't cover all possibilities. And when none of these are satisfied, I simply set the braking force to be zero. So I mustn't hide this too much because I may have to bring it up again. Let me now show you these ingredients here, maybe one at a time, something like this. So I said that there was a factor Q in the braking force. Q we said to be proportional to the density. This is rather standard, by the way. And then P is the lane change probability, and so 1 minus P is the braking probability. And you should be careful because, of course, this will depend on the lane. I suppressed the lane index here in order to keep things simple. The lane change probability, for that you can make an ansatz because you don't really know what it is. But and it turns out this is extremely important because what the challenge for a good model is to produce so-called fundamental diagrams, which are simply the relationship between density of and flux in equilibrium. And the fundamental diagrams are multi-valued in observations, that is known. And the challenge is to reproduce this. And the speculation is that it has to do with the lane changing behavior of drivers. So you have to bring the lane changing behavior of drivers in that. And by the way, you only expect the multi-value fundamental diagrams on multi-lane highways. This is not a theory for single lane highways. So what we did is we simply took this as a probability, right? That's why the scaling is here. By the way, Umax is just the speed limit. I call it sometimes Umax, sometimes Vmax. And there is a parameter here. And so this is, of course, nonlinear in U. And U is going to be coupled to the kinetic density. It's just the bulk velocity. So I've said everything that is written here. And the final ingredient, not the final, but a very important ingredient that was already mentioned, is this, yes?
Can you remind me, if U is the average flow and the flow?
Yeah, that's why I show you. This is the trouble with these transparencies. You can't just... U, this is the flux, and U is basically the flux divided by the density. That's what it is. Of course it should, but this is an ingredient that we have not... This is the next stage in the model, okay? We haven't done that yet. We didn't need to. You can make it more and more complicated. We first wanted to see what would happen if we make it only dependent on the conditions in the current lane. You're absolutely right. It will depend in reality on what happens in the lane next to you.
Can I ask you a question as a driver, not a cyclist? Why do you think the speed limit is observed?
It's not. It's another simplification. We can, this is a conversation that we should have over coffee later. I did. Well, I don't want to spend my time on that now. I have 3 projects to show you, right, and a movie. Anyway, see, here, I mentioned earlier, I add an index B when I include the non-localities. So because these quantities, the density at another spot and the average speed at another spot, enters into your braking forces. And so there are really a number of... see here, the tar is the individual reaction time. That's usually around a second or so, but it's there. And then there is a safety distance, which we call HB. That's maybe a couple of car lengths or so. And then there is a characteristic reaction time that has to do with braking, TEB. This is much more than the tar, typically, and that multiplies your individual speed. And there is another such time for acceleration scenarios, and these guys, these non-localities enter. Notice in particular that, of course, suddenly this rho B depends really, in terms of location, on your speed. And yet, I mean, I said the braking force is proportional to your relative speed. So this is where this implicit relationship on the right-hand side comes from. It's quite delicate, rather. The lane change rates. Lane change rates are simply taken to be lane change probabilities, these guys up here, times the flux on your lane, times the dimensional constant. Dimensionally, that's just what you need. But, I mean, it leads to some complications because you have the flux here later on. For diffusion, we chose a degenerate diffusion. You might wonder why we did that, right? But essentially, what's the cause of diffusion in traffic? Well, it's the ability of the driver to make accurate reactions to the traffic situation. Or rather, the inability. You cannot estimate, as you drive, relative velocities with any reliability. So you make mistakes. But what this says here is that the mistake that you make is in some sense proportional to the power of your relative speed to the traffic in front of you. If you drive exactly at that relative speed, what this says is you make no mistakes. That's a simplification. And probably a more accurate diffusion would add a little residual constant here, an epsilon, which accounts for the jitteriness of drivers in traffic, which is, of course, very important. But for the time being, we ignored this, and in fact, this degeneracy that is in here makes the system, in the simplest case, it makes it a degenerate drift diffusion system, and which displays rather interesting behavior. Of course, this is what I want to show you. Okay. Well, what are the properties of this system? I told you already that our first objective was to compute fundamental diagrams. Fundamental diagrams are really functional relationships between flux and density, or equivalently, average speed and density in equilibrium. Okay? This is, of course, a statistical theory, because you cannot really talk about cars at the same spot moving with different speeds. But we can't do the same, if you really think about it, we cannot do the same in kinetic theory either. It's also a statistical theory. So we want to be able to compute this, and this actually is sort of a listing of the properties. I want to first show you, this is something that some of the people in the audience may already have seen. I want to first show you how we do this. And first, I'll show you some measurements, observations rather, made by a man named Boris Kerner, who works for Daimler Chrysler in Stuttgart. And he made in 1997, that's when these particular measurements were made, he measured on the Autobahn that goes from Frankfurt to Oberwolfach, right, the A5. Where there are no speed limits. But of course, the point is, the speed limits do not matter too much as soon as you get moderately dense traffic. And in fact, the theory that I'm showing you sort of is very questionable when there is very low car density, and it's also very questionable when there is very high car density. But I don't care, because these are both trivial scenarios. In one case, you have a complete smoothness flow, and the other case, you have standing traffic. I do not need a theory to explain that. It's in the intermediate regime where things are interesting. And see, what he measured there is, by the way, Q is what I call J here, and here is the traffic density. By the way, the flux is much easier to measure than the density, because you just count cars going by. And what he observed is that, in fact, with the density initially, you get a linear increase, which is exactly what you expect, right, because there's free driving. But then, above the critical value, there seems to be a bifurcation, because there's a second branch here, on the left lane too. He also observed that traffic tends to synchronize in a reasonable traffic regime, and then he speculated a little bit about the synchronization regime. I don't want to comment on this last thing. And now I'll show you, our first objective was to reproduce this using our model. And here's what we did. And for the I apologize for the next transparency, because this is the most technical transparency I show today. How do we compute fundamental diagrams? Well, we look at the model in a completely homogeneous scenario. I said it's at equilibrium. If you are in a completely homogeneous scenario, both lanes will look the same. There will be no time and no x dependence. You get a completely homogeneous equation. And also, all the non-localities disappear, because they all involve time and x. Okay, so the equation in this case actually decomposes into two ordinary differential equations, which look a little bit ugly here. So your density is between zero and the maximal density. The maximum is, of course, when you have bumper-to-bumper traffic, right? Then you can't squeeze any more cars in, even though our traffic planners would love to do just that. And so remember, in a braking scenario, this is braking scenario, remember here we have these terms, V minus U squared times density times the braking probability times the unknown. And this is the diffusion term times the first derivative of F. That has to be equal to zero, because you solve the thing with zero flux boundary conditions. And the other half, for the acceleration scenario, you have a slightly different ordinary differential equation. The point is, you solve these explicitly. They're not very hard to solve at all. It's an exercise in ordinary differential equation theory. Here are the solutions. They're essentially piecewise Maxwellians. And you multiply the constants C1 and C2. Of course, you have constraints, right? Usually, if you make C1 equal to C2, the two pieces at the average speed link up continuously. This is what we first did, because we thought it's reasonable. And it is reasonable if you have a residual diffusion. But remember that we are in the degenerate case here. I want to study the degenerate case. By the way, this alpha and beta here, I don't want to comment much on them, but they show up, and they are there in order to handle the extremal cases that I already mentioned, the free flow and the expanding traffic scenario. Anyway, what you do then, down here in that little corner, I wrote in black what you do once you have the solution. You may, first of all, force continuity at the point where you go from a braking to an acceleration regime, and that means the two constants here should be the same. You still have an arbitrary constant, but you have the constraint that the integral over f has to be equal to the density, and you have a second constraint, namely you want that this integral here has to be equal to zero. That just says that u should be the average speed for your traffic. So this second here gives you now a functional of rho and u, which you put in as parameters, and you are looking for the roots of this functional. That root, these roots give you the fundamental diagram. And of course, this is what we did first, and many of you have seen this picture before, because this is what was the exciting part about this whole thing. This is what we got as a fundamental diagram. Now, what's exciting about this is down here you see the flux, up here you see the average speed. Let's look at the flux. So it looks a lot like Kerner's, of course, qualitatively, not quantitatively. It looks a lot like Kerner's measurement. And then you get this second branch, which is quite low here. But, of course, we had just to guess initially what our parameters should be in the model. And up here, you see there are these two branches. And I emphasize, every point on this diagram, what you see down here is the density, and the other axis is the average speed here. Every point on this diagram corresponds to a continuous, steady, spatially homogeneous solution. Okay. Let me bring this property thing back here. I have to stay very organized here. Well, one reason why we threw in the degeneracy, by the way, this gamma is the exponent of the V minus U in the diffusion coefficient. If that is positive, you can show that there are, you can see, this is a very immediate, you can see that there are trivial equilibria solutions which are just the Dirac delta functions at which, where all the drivers are moving with average speed. We wanted these because I argued they are real. You should have them. Whether they are really to be taken seriously in such a statistical theory is debatable, but we included them. Okay. What we did then is we wanted to see what happens asymptotically if you just study the spatially homogeneous equation. By the way, Jean Dolbeau and I analyzed this problem from an analytical point of view and were able to prove using relative entropy methods that you do in fact expect convergence. And then we wanted to verify what happens with numerical experiments. And I'll show you, I have a lot of pictures. I'll show you what came out of the numerical experiments before I go to the next little bit here. Look at the lower picture here first. The upper picture I'll explain a little later. We took various initial data and let them run. And what happened is that we got equilibria, which actually displayed a discontinuity at the average speed. And that was a bit of a surprise. Of course, in hindsight, it's not a surprise. The degeneracy is consistent with that. The degenerate diffusion allows that. And essentially, what if you include such equilibria, you get many, many more possibilities for the fundamental diagram. This is what is displayed up here. See, if you look, they are the same solutions of the ordinary differential equations, but now the two constants for the two pieces, C1 and C2, are not equal. What we did actually solve is a time-dependent problem with randomly chosen initial values. I'll show you a few examples in a moment. And let them go. And watch where does the solution asymptotically go. The time-dependent spatially homogeneous problem. And it went to solutions to asymptotic states of this type. And so we realized that one has to take these equilibria with a discontinuity at the equilibrium seriously because they are stable, right? They are asymptotically stable in this sense, and it's the degenerate diffusion that allows this. Why may this be of some use? I do not take this seriously from a practical point of view, by the way, because I believe that residual diffusion is relevant. But residual diffusion is probably small, and so if you do a long-time calculation, you may first go to the neighborhood of one of these guys and then experience a slow relaxation to one of the continuous equilibria. That, I think, is a realistic scenario. And why may this be important? Well, measurements that I've seen actually from traffic engineers from here in Toronto indicate that when you measure the fundamental diagram, you do not only see what Kerner observed, you actually see, rather than these bifurcations, you measure all kinds of states in such intermediate domains. And they may just be metastable states that are close to one of these discontinuous equilibria before you go to the final continuous steady state, but you go there slowly. And in real traffic, of course, you never see that because real traffic is never completely homogeneous. So depending on what kind of ratio you take between these two constants, C1 and C2, you get different types of fundamental diagrams, because whatever discontinuity you allow gives you a new branch here. So we thought this satisfying in a sense, because it may be an explanation for these rather dense graphs. The analytical explanation for the discontinuities is actually very elementary, and I mean, I was almost embarrassed not to have seen this beforehand. Here it is. See, our system in the homogeneous, spatially homogeneous case is of this type. And of course, we have a complicated flux functions with all these braking and acceleration terms, but the structure is a lot like the structure that I indicated here. This factor here has the right sign structure for braking and acceleration. Here's the type of diffusion that we have. And you would solve this, of course, always with zero flux boundary conditions in order to ensure mass conservation. And mass conservation is the only invariant you have, by the way, in this business. So, but of course, if you take a good look at the flux function, you see that the flux function, because of the degeneracy, is zero exactly at the average velocity. And so if you then look at the following three scenarios, let's first look at the case where U is simply a constant given, a linear equation. If you do that, I look at three cases, U given and constant, U given as a function of t, and third, the case at hand where U is in fact a moment of our density. And then you immediately would think of studying the densities that drive below average velocities, those that drive above average velocities, and let's look at their derivatives. Well, it's a completely immediate consequence of the fundamental theorem that this derivative is just the value of the density at time t at U times the derivative of U. Now, if U is given and constant, this is zero. So rho minus and rho plus are invariants. And depending on what initial state you choose, of course, they will go to a profile, but that explains why there will be a jump. There must be a jump in order to be consistent with the profile. In the other two cases here, you expect that these will converge to limits, provided that the U of t converges fast enough. And convergence of U was just what Jean Dolbeau and I proved it was proved actually in 2002, it was published last year. The convergence we got was a rather weak convergence, but we have convergence nonetheless. So that is a qualitative explanation why you see the formation of these discontinuities. Okay. Good. Before I show you just make sure I stay organized here. I'll show you a bunch of results of numerical experiments, but let me first talk briefly about synchronization. Well, Kerner reported that he observed this, and our model realizes it numerically very well. I'll show you a couple of examples before I talk more about analysis. Here's an example. The scales are not exactly the same, unfortunately. This was done with MATLAB, and it scaled automatically. So the initial values that were taken were, on one lane, we took an equilibrium, right, with a relatively large average velocity. On the other lane, we took, I think this is the left lane, this is the right lane, but it doesn't matter because we treat them as completely symmetric. And on the other lane, we took also an equilibrium with a relatively low average velocity. And then we let the system go, and drivers will change lanes. It's the lane-changing terms, of course, that drive the synchronization. And here's the equilibrium that arose on both lanes. And notice it does have a discontinuity. You don't see it exactly, but that's a numerical artifact. Okay. And Mike Laherty repeated that calculation with other initial values. Here he took a sine profile here, and here took a linear profile for the densities. And again, you got the same equilibrium. Actually, it synchronizes very fast. Now, there are interesting, this is a little bit of an interesting analytical challenge, because the question was, can you prove this? Of course, on the right-hand side of the system, we have lane change terms of this flavor. In this, we took a simplified model. This was what Vlad Panferov and I did together. We took a simplified model and said, let's just see whether we can prove synchronization for a simpler case where you don't have all these complicated braking and acceleration terms. We just took a constant diffusion, ignored braking and acceleration, and focused on the lane changing terms. But it is still nonlinear because the J2 and J1 here are moments of F2 and F1. Right? So there's a non-locality hidden in there. And Vlad actually came up with a rather elegant proof that this system here will in fact converge exponentially fast, will synchronize exponentially fast. Here are some of the key ideas. Of course, you have a conservation of the sum of the two. That just satisfies the ordinary heat equation with the Neumann boundary conditions, and so it converges to a constant. And then if you take capital J is, of course, the moment of capital F, right, the flux, here it is, and that will then also converge. And this is enough, in fact, to prove, using Fourier expansion techniques, to prove the synchronization property. Well, the last feature that is always something that people are interested in, and something that almost all of you must have experienced, is the phenomenon of stop and go waves on the highway. And the question is, does the model reproduce that? So this is, of course, something that I don't see really a chance to do this analytically, because now you have to solve the full spatially homogeneous time-dependent problem with all the non-localities. We did it numerically. And here's the scenario, very simple scenario, right? We take a two-lane highway, everything moves to the right, and then we block one lane and force people to change lanes. This is what you typically see in a construction site, right, or an accident or something, or the police imposes a roadblock. And, of course, if traffic density is very high, it's boring, right? Then one car moves at a time. If traffic density is very low, it's also boring, just like before. It's the intermediate traffic densities where you expect that as you go back here, you would see the propagation of stop-and-go waves. And we found that. I'll show you a couple of pictures, and I have a movie of that. This is why I have the laptop. This is a true multimedia show. Yes? The mechanism would be different on a one-lane road. And see, the challenge was really, usually these things are observed. It's not really understood where they come from. The speculation was that it would come from the lane change terms. And we found that for this model, okay? I mean, I do not believe that this model is adequate for a one-lane road, and I don't believe that you need kinetic theory at all for one-lane roads. But that's a different matter. I can answer this another time. We found that in order to actually get stop-and-go waves, you need three essential ingredients here. Well, you need, of course, a trigger, right? The trigger would be the block here that you go from two lanes to one lane. The spatial, I have a spelling error here, there should be only one L. The spatial non-locality turns out to be essential. If you think about it, of course, you look ahead, you react to what's ahead of you, and this is the only mechanism that will propagate things backwards. And in fact, remember that in the model we have this rho index B, which is rho evaluated at some place ahead. Actually, I had T minus tau here earlier. And the third ingredient that turns out to be essential for this is, in fact, the bifurcated fundamental diagram. Axel and the people in Darmstadt ran experiments where they said, okay, let's remove the spatial non-locality. In fact, this we did in Victoria first. We removed that. No stop-and-go waves. They didn't show up in the model. And then we put this in, and then I said, aha, it's the spatial non-locality. But then in Darmstadt, they went ahead and said, okay, let's change the model such that we lose the bifurcation, the multi-valued property of the fundamental diagram. This, by the way, this is easy to do. If you make the lane change probability dependent only on the density and not on the average velocity, you lose the bifurcation. I can explain why that is, but not in the time available. So they removed that by changing the lane change probability, and the stop and go waves disappeared. And what kind of stop and go waves do you get if you see this? You get to see this twice. See, these pictures are as follows. You have two lanes, rho 1 and J1. The density of the flux correspond to one lane, and this is the other lane. And the first lane gets blocked here where that little X is. And this is, of course, sometime into the blockade. I mean, the blockade appears suddenly. Initially, there are no cars out here, but they come from back here. Notice the density is sort of 0.25, means there's always three spaces of empty spaces between any two cars. Fluxes are, they had to choose initial velocity distributions, which were taken from the equilibria that we have. And then you see actually the waves propagating backwards on both lanes. See, here, of course, you see the cars driving off into the sunset with ever-growing speed and flux. But here, needless to say, nothing happens here because it's blocked. I have another picture, and then I'll show you the movie. It's commercial time. Well, they depend rather sensitively on the chosen densities and on the scenario. This is not so terribly surprising because of the time delay. So let me turn this off for a moment, and I'll show you the movie now. Hope everything works. This thing here went dormant. There we go. Okay. This is the very first time I'm doing something like this. I'm all excited. Okay, here are the movies. Some of them are just benchmark tests, where both lanes were kept open to make sure that these are not artifacts of the numerics. They were also done with low resolution and high resolution. I think this one is a good one. Let me just stop it and first explain the scenario and make it big as I can. I don't know how to do this. Anyway, but I'm limited with my technological abilities. Fortunately, young people are not. So there is one graph here that you should ignore. That's the middle one, because Hertie also, these are calculations that took a couple of days, I think, because he did them with high resolution to make sure they were reliable. Here you see essentially the same thing that I showed you on the view graph, the densities on the two lanes, and down here the fluxes. The velocities were calculated as quotients between the two. And so, because for numerical reasons, there is a little residual density left here, very small, and a little residual flux here, which are, of course, not realistic. But what the computer does, he computes the quotients of them and gets a huge average speed here. So that means the cars that are not there can drive very fast. But, of course, it doesn't make any sense. Now let's run it. X-axis is the road. What you see here is basically a piece of the road at an appropriate scale, and what you see here is, of course, the density and flux. At this particular location here, this lane is blocked, but this one is open. So let's start it. I should have music with this, but of course you could hear the driver's curse and behind the music. So you see the waves propagate backwards. Notice the artifact that is here that you shouldn't really pay attention to. I could entertain you now for the rest of the lecture with the selection of movies I have. They vary a great deal depending on what kind of initial densities and fluxes you take on the two lanes, explaining that there is a fair bit of sensitivity, at least predicted by this model. I mean, the model is a model in flux. It's still being refined, and I mean, certain things like the lane change probability being dependent on what's going on the neighboring lane is very important and should be implemented. Well, you see here at the end, we have really nice waves that have propagated backwards. Well, yes, they are not very high in amplitude. That may be subjective. It may be a subjective impression to you that they are smaller, you know. I mean, because how do you measure traffic density in reality? It's the inverse of the average distance to the driver in front of you. You also find, of course, stop and go wave in very high density traffic. But in that very high density traffic, there must be other mechanisms than the one we employ here, because this is based on lane changing. And in very high density traffic, you don't change lanes. Okay, so let me log off here. I didn't hear that comment, but of course, this is a subject that offers itself to. Maybe I'll leave this on if you have any time at the end. You put this on standby. I took a crash course this morning in technology. So that's what I have to say about traffic today. Oh, sure. Yeah, it's included. See, the distance is included implicitly because when you look at the braking terms, there was a factor rho in there, the density, the macroscopic density, which is basically the macroscopic density is inversely proportional to the average distance. So it's exactly there, and it should be. Yes? The beginning of the model.
The collision term and not the force term.
On the right hand side. I don't like to think it as a collision term, first of all, because when we set out to this, the first paper that you wrote it is called the Vlasov-Fokker-Planck equation, because I like the Vlasov equation, I thought of it, and I had exactly the same idea that, but the diffusion here, well, of course, it is in some sense a collision term, because the diffusion does depend through the moment on the, the short answer is I agree with you. It could be written on the right-hand side. It could be written as a collision term, if you want. But what the mechanism is, actually, is something I don't understand. See, but everybody tells you, you have to have such a term in the model.
It looks like your brain diffusion.
Something like that. Something like that. It's a psychological diffusion. Yes?
Anyway, I'd like to pick up on the remark you made that on the single lane, you don't really need a genetic description.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know there are many genetic descriptions of single lane traffic, and some of them make a prediction of something called phantom jam, and lots of the numbers which are quite strict, but who actually appear in real traffic. So, why do you think that I can even mention some name that gives helping?
Yeah. I would, can I defer the answer to that to the coffee break? Because, see, I have only 15 minutes or 10, and I have two more projects to show. See, this is not a thing that I can answer in one sentence. But essentially, well, let me modify it. I think what you need to do is have a very different type of kinetic model if you want to use a type of kinetic model. I think for single lane traffic, I would be inclined to believe that you can get by either with just stochastic simulation of car interactions, or by modeling with the conservation law type of equation. But why, we can argue about this, but I'd like to talk about this. Yes. or beer. Anyway, let me come to my... This is more an advertisement. This will be short, and the third project will also be short. A year and a half ago, Michael Jung from Kaiserslautern came to visit me in Victoria, and he said, I'd like to investigate the following problem. In an industrial process where they make plastic artifacts, like baby car seats or baby potties or things like that, the manufacturing process is that they take a liquid plastic and they pour it into a mold, and then it hardens and you get the final product. And somebody had the idea to change the elastic properties of that final product by including little fibers, little short fibers of a different type of material. Could be metal, could be glass, and they will flow with that Stokes flow of the plastic and orient themselves according to the flow and eventually form a distribution of some kind and alter in the process the elastic properties. So here you see an example of something like this where, of course, it's congealed, and this, I trust this is an ultrasound picture or a radiological picture. I copied it out of a report from Kaiserslautern, where many of such fibers have oriented themselves. It looks like there are many more than there really are, because it's really three-dimensional, right, and you look through the whole thing. So the challenge is to come up with a good kinetic theory to describe the motion of these fibers and basically try to explain what kind of typical asymptotic distribution of orientations you'd get. By the way, I mean one paper of many, many, many that I can't all quote here, because this problem, of course, is also finds a lot of interest in the field called, what are they called? The word escapes me right now. Anyway, if you take long fibers in a fluid, you need to explain first how they move. And the classical paper on that is a paper by a British physicist named Jeffrey and his wife, also named Jeffrey. And in 1922, they solved the problem of an elongated ellipse moving in Stokes' flow. They solved it explicitly except the paper is very hard to read, especially from a modern point of view, because they essentially, maybe some of you have looked at this paper, it's a classic. Anyway, if you look at, this is three-dimensional, right, but the ellipsoid has basically a very narrow diameter D, and that it's circular around it, and otherwise it has length L, and there is a parameter that we need that's called the aspect ratio, which is called lambda. And what Jeffrey described is that the motion of the orientation of such a piece of fiber, such an ellipsoid, is described by this equation, where U is basically the flow field, which is here simply Stokes' flow. Of course, if you have a small fiber, you will usually assume that you have locally a linear flow field. And what happens here is you have to have the cross product of the curl of the flow field. And then you have this extra term where S is just the symmetric part of the Jacobian of the flow field. This is called Jeffrey's equation. And as I said, it's quoted a lot in the literature, and the derivation is given in this old paper. What Jeffrey actually did in the paper, they solved the Stokes equation around a fixed elliptical object in three-dimensional space explicitly. And then once you have that, once you have the idea, you can of course figure out what the forces are and how fast that thing will rotate. So here's our project, and as I said, this is more an advertisement. What we have done, this is the only other transparency I have, and then the last 2 minutes I'll talk about coal. This equation has certainly the property that the square of the norm of P is invariant, which it should, because we are only interested in the orientation. So P is an element of S2. Here are some objectives that we are pursuing. And I mean, this is well underway, by the way. We don't have a finished paper yet. We would like, I should give almost full credit to Michael Jung, because he did almost all the work. I just let him use my office. So he gave a derivation, a modern derivation of the Jeffrey's equation, basically on the asymptotic expansions of the Navier-Stokes equations in this, for the situation at hand. And then the next thing that we want to do, that is more in progress, and that is kinetic theory. We would like to derive a statistical version for the density function of orientations, position, and time. So notice this is kind of an unusual, an exotic problem in kinetic theory, because the space on which we operate is not just Cartesian space. I mean, the first argument, P, lives on, I'll use my finger, I can't see this thing, lives on S2, okay? So, and what the statistical version that is actually presently in use is written down here. So you put this P dot, this is you insert the right-hand side of the Jeffrey's equation here, and these have to be covariant derivatives on this sphere, which enter here. The question is really, here we just put a diffusion, sort of. And the question is, C is usually taken proportional to the effective shear rate. The justification of the diffusion is that if there are enough of these fibers in the fluid, that they will start to influence each other's motion. And the challenge is, what is a reasonable model for the collisional or other interaction of these fibers in the model to put there instead of that diffusion? Yeah, the flow field is given. It's a Stokes flow. Right. If you take the full nonlinear Navier-Stokes equations, you're talking about a problem that is well, maybe you can do it. I sure can't. It's a very hard problem. Pardon? Between the fibers? No. See, the outside Stokes flow is not assumed to be influenced by the motion of the fiber. That is one of the fundamental assumptions. Yes, quite dilute. If you have very many fibers, the model certainly does not apply anymore. I think I've overextended myself a little bit, but I want to talk at least a couple of minutes about coal dust here, and then there's another speaker after me, and I don't want to go into his time. I'm happy that there are so many questions, by the way, but I'm here all day. So, this last problem was suggested to me by Sergei Razanov from Saarbrücken, and there is a PhD thesis by an engineer named Kanter, who wrote this at the Technical University in Braunschweig. Consider the problem where you have a container, let's say an oven, an incinerator, and you fill it with coal dust. Typically, this is brown coal, and it's, of course, used in a lot of places, including here in Ontario, but also in the northwestern Germany. And then this is, of course, immersed in air, and you put this air in very rapid turbulent motion, and you want to find out what is going to be the distribution function of the coal dust. Of course, what they really want to do is ignite it and burn it most efficiently to generate electrical energy. So this is a problem of significant importance. But let's just look at the mathematical equation that comes up. Here it is, the time-dependent case. Well, what do you need in this case, right? Of course, the usual transport stuff. F is the distribution function of the coal particles. Then you would have a Fokker-Planck term, because there are two things that happen. The coal particles, of course, experience friction as they move through the air, and they experience a Brownian motion with a certain diffusion coefficient. But then they interact with each other through really inelastic collisions. And here, this is the inelastic collision operator, where I put an index E to indicate there is a restitution coefficient that has to do with the collisions between the coal particles. And I don't need to say much more about this, because there will be two talks later this morning where we will see, where we'll hear about granular flow. So this is a problem where you get a Fokker-Planck type term coupled with an inelastic collision term. And the third ingredient here that I haven't alluded to yet is that you have, of course, to take boundary conditions seriously. And in this particular problem, what I know from the engineers is that the boundary conditions are, in fact, a huge problem, because the coal particles tend to hit this, but then get emitted from the host surface, or they can accrete and form these coal sheets that are hard to burn, that they really don't like. Or sometimes they glide along the wall and then get re-emitted. So this is a problem with a horrible conditions. And now I come to my last slide, which I take the liberty to show. See, what they really want to know is what would be the high velocity tails of the distribution in this problem. And it's interesting, because the Fokker-Planck part would predict you just get some kind of Maxwellian distribution. But the inelastic Boltzmann part, as we know from the work of Gamba, Bobilev, Panferov, and many others, would predict that you get a slower tail, e to the power minus v to the power minus 3/2. Plus 3/2, sorry, there's a mistake here. But anyway, so the question is, which one is it going to be? Or is it going to be some combination of the two? Which term will dominate the distribution function? Now, Sergei Razanov has produced a code to solve this. I know that so far it's only in two dimensions, because three-dimensional simulations are very expensive and time-consuming. But from an analytical point of view, this is actually a very hard problem, because what we would like to solve is a steady problem. And even in the simplest case, we found that even if you look at the Fokker-Planck scenario, there isn't much. There's one paper that goes back to Bawendi and Griswold. By the way, only in a French name could you have four vowels in sequence. I'm always impressed to seeing Bawendi's name. Anyway, 1968, and they studied this problem. They used very different terminology, that if you look at the paper, it takes a second to see that basically what they did here is not the Fokker-Planck. They used a heat equation in velocity with a transfer term on the left and inflow boundary conditions. And so what you want to solve is this. They call it a mixed type problem. But if you look here, for positive V, you have inflow here. For negative V, you have inflow here. But, of course, the whole mess mixes in the middle. And so they provide a very elegant solution based on a variational principle and a theorem by Jacques Lyons. And the only work that I know where this has been adapted to the Fokker-Planck equation, which you need to do first to do this, is a paper by Pierre de Gaulle, who I'm very happy to have in the audience, in 1986. Thanks, Pierre. I wrote here because this is sort of the starting point to address this bigger problem. We need, the hope is, of course, that the Fokker Planck term will regularize enough in order to make the inelastic collision term tractable. This is what we are working on. It's a joint project with Vlad Panferov. Sorry for going over time, but you asked me too many questions. Thank you very much.